All right. Good morning. The court calls United States v. Fry. Counsel for the appellant, please.
Good morning, Chief Judge Baker, members of this honorable court. May it please the court. I am Captain Michael Schremmer, and along with Colonel Patrick Wells, we represent the appellant in this case, Staff Sergeant Daniel Fry. The Air Force Court of Appeals erred in finding there was no showing of prejudice where trial counsel conceded no evidence of similar misconduct, but then stated, but think of what we know, common sense, ways of the world about child molesters. Trial counsel attempted to fan the flames of the jury's fears by predicting that if they did not adjudge a harsh punishment, some calamity would consume their community. When applying this improper comment to the three-part test in Fletcher, it is clear that these comments prejudice the appellant, and as a result, this court cannot be confident that appellant was properly sentenced on the weight of the evidence.
How is he prejudiced? They asked for 10, he got 8. How is he prejudiced?
Your Honor, when the members adjudged 8, they adjudged 8 based on the trial counsel's comments that they needed a harsh punishment because of the propensity of the appellant to recommit this crime. So they essentially sentenced the appellant to 8 years as for not only the crime he committed, but the future crimes that he would commit.
Do you think that 8 years, an 8-year sentence for rape of an aggravated sexual contact of someone under the age of 12, that's based on them flaming the passions? I mean, that's a surprising sentence.
Your Honor, in this case, based on the trial counsel's comments and also the comments by the military judge, I think that the members adjudged the sentence based on the likelihood that he would recommit these crimes. And that there is the prejudice. The prejudice is the delta between the 8 years that he was convicted as a possible multiple-time child molester versus what the members would have convicted him on based on the evidence alone and based on the crime that he was convicted.
Hasn't the Supreme Court held that the likelihood of recidivism is a subject that's relevant to sentencing?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Well, then, where do we get from that to here? Is this more? Is he arguing more than the likelihood of recidivism? What's he arguing?
Your Honor, I think a case that the government cited in their brief is instructive on this case, U.S. v. Williams, where the government wants to put forth specific evidence that the accused has some sort of rate of recidivism, they can do that. But the key is, Your Honor, they need to do that correctly. They have to put forth the effort and go through the steps of giving that evidence to the panel members. And in the case of Williams, they called an expert to talk about the accused chances of recidivism. And this court said that as far as it goes to rehabilitation, that is information that can be put
forward. Was there any evidence in this record regarding recidivism of someone convicted of a child offense?
No, no.
Zero?
Yes, Your Honor.
Where does ways of the world come from?
Your Honor, Your Honor, are you asking case law, where does that come from?
Who invented the phrase? And how do we know that members know what ways of the world are? When should a member apply the ways of the world? Is this something that goes to credibility, or should members... Is rates of recidivism something that every member would know as a way of the world? Is this a good term of art to have in sentencing? A bad term of art? Please comment.
Your Honor, I don't know if I can ask that the later part of your question, but I can say that when selecting members' devices, as the military judge said, to consider your common sense and ways of the world as it relates to child molesters, that is not the correct province of your common sense and knowledge of
the problem that members, what, the rate of recidivism of child molesters is not something inherently within the knowledge of members like credibility is, or is the problem that we don't know what ways of the world means? What I'm trying to say is that if I'm writing an opinion that says military judges stop using ways of the world, or only use it in cases involving credibility, or only use it in cases where you're supposed to infer technical knowledge that nobody else knows, what am I supposed to put in there?
Your Honor, this court, as the government cited in their brief, cases such as Oakley, Wilson, Rivera, this court has touched upon the use of common sense and knowledge of the ways of the world. And it relates to what it is, the member's common sense and knowledge of the world. So in cases where they can look at a witness and judge credibility, or they can evaluate lay testimony, or a parental discipline defense, drawing on their experience as parents, that is in the correct province of the members to draw on those experiences. The members don't have common sense and knowledge of the ways of the world as it results to the recidivism rate of a child molester. So to answer your question, Your Honor, I mean, I think this court has weighed in on how common sense and knowledge of the ways of the world can be utilized by a panel of members. And I think in this specific case, this has clearly outstepped that, and we've now gone into the realm of clearly facts that were not in evidence.
Counsel, does ways of the world, can that be substituted for evidence that's not in the record, or is it used to analyze evidence that's in the record?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I missed the first part of that question.
Ways of the world, can it be used to substitute for evidence that's not in the record, or is it used to analyze evidence that is in the record?
Your Honor, it is not a substitute for evidence that is not in the record. Evidence before the panel members needs to be properly put there by one of the two parties.
And have we ever defined or talked or delved into this ways of the world and common knowledge and all this other stuff other than just saying it?
Your Honor, besides, it has been referenced in cases such as I just spoke of a second ago, is that the members can consider this information. Your Honor, I have no specific knowledge of where it's been delved into as far as a specific definition of how it's to be used.
Should we infer anything from the fact that it was in the 5169 manual but dropped from the 84 manual and not included since?
Your Honor, it's an interesting question. I mean, there is case law out there that has survived that is still instructional. I don't know if the fact that it was omitted, I think it certainly should be binding on this court's decision.
Isn't that the question? How valid would that case law be at this juncture if the basis for it is no longer in law?
And, Your Honor, that's something that should be taken into account. Although not in the further iterations of the manual, there was no specific verbiage taking that back or outlawing it or, outright undoing previous case law. But it is a term of art that is vastly overused by government counsel. And that's something that this court should take into consideration, not only its vast overuse.
What do we do in a case like this where the government asks for 10 years and the defense comes up and argues for something less than 10 years and they sentence him to 8 years? Didn't he get what they asked for? You'd have a better argument if he got 10 years.
Your Honor, but in that decision, we don't know if but for the argument that unless you lock this guy up for a really long time, because if you don't, he's going to go do this again to other little girls, maybe they would have given him 3 years. And again, that goes back, that's the delta between the prejudicial argument and here the prejudicial sentence that we have, and...
But you would agree that's somewhat speculative. I mean, you're essentially arguing he could have gotten no sentence at all, and we'll never know, will we?
Certainly, Your Honor.
But he did get less than what the trial counsel asked for.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's what the defense counsel asked for, right? Give him something less than 10 years.
Yes, Your Honor.
So the defense counsel, for example, aware of the ways of the world, didn't ask the members to give him 2 years for rape of a child under 12.
No, no. But that, at the end of the day, that's we don't know that. But here, the defense counsel did make a timely argument to this improper argument, which the judge had overruled. But that now shifts the burden to the government to answer these questions of whether this argument...
Okay. Now, what's preserved here? They didn't object at the beginning. They objected at the end. Does that sweep the whole thing, or what?
Well, Your Honor, I think what the defense counsel did was, at the exact moment of this specific improper argument...
Right. No, he did object then. Right.
They did object there, okay. Yes, Your Honor. And while we're talking about the instructions, the second prong of the Fletcher test is the curative measures taken by the judge. And I think this is an important part to touch upon because, as we said in the beginning, or as I just said a second ago, when the military judge overruled the defense counsel's objection, that military judge lended credit to what the trial counsel was telling them. That if they did not, if they did not give this harsh punishment, then this calamity would pursue, and that they could use their common sense in the ways of the world. This was further exacerbated by the fact that in the sentencing instructions, the military judge basically said, this is not, these are not facts in evidence, but you can, based on the arguments made, you can use your common sense and ways of the world in judging a sentence. So in one respect, they said, hey, this isn't an evidence, but then go right ahead and use this information as you may to adjudge that sentence. So if one of those members common sense and ways of the world of what they knew was that the only way to stop a child molester is to give them lengthy confinement to stop them from future harm, then that's what that member did in their sentence.
What about 1001 says that a specific deterrence is a permissible subject of sentencing. Specific deterrence, of course, is the deterrence of the individual at bar. Are there any limits on that, and if so, what?
Your Honor, I think the limit was surpassed in this case.
You said it's surpassed, but what is it?
I think, first of all, any time that a counsel relies on facts that are not in evidence to support their proposition to the panel members, that is one clear delineating line.
Okay.
And I think in this case, obviously, relying on facts that were not in evidence took the specific deterrence to a place that was improper.
Okay.
And the last thing about the military judge's curative instruction, as this court has annotated in Fletcher and Marsh, one of the ways to cure an improper comment by trial counsel is at the very moment that the improper comment is made is to give a curative instruction at that time to the panel members. And in this case, there obviously was no curative instruction. In fact, the military judge had overruled the objection, lending credence to it. Your Honor, I see at this time I have a few minutes left. If there are no further questions.
You can save it for rebuttal if you wish.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Counsel of the Government.
Chief Judge Baker, honorable members of the court, good morning and may it please the court. My name is Captain Matthew Neal, and I represent the United States in this matter. Appellant's claim before this court should be denied, and his sentence should be affirmed for two simple reasons. One, trial counsel's argument was not error, and two, even if it was error, Appellant suffered no prejudice.
Counsel, you didn't appeal, make a separate appeal as to the CCA's decision that it was error. And in looking at the issue that we granted, it clearly was granted as to whether or not that was a prejudicial error and whether the CCA erred finding that it was not prejudicial. So how do you come in now and attack the CCA's determination that you haven't done formally?
Thank you, Judge Erdman, for two reasons. And I think what's alluded to there is the law of the case doctrine. The government didn't appeal whether or not it was error specifically. For two reasons, I would say the law of the case doctrine would not apply in this case. The first is that we do believe that the framed issue, whether or not this was harmless error, puts the issue of sentencing argument squarely before this court. And as we know from United States versus Marsh, this court looks at sentencing argument and improper argument de novo. In order for error to be harmless, it must first be error. So we think certainly squarely there it's before this court.
But we changed our rules to specifically allow the government to appeal that in situations like this so that both the court and the other party would have the opportunity to receive briefs on this from both parties and put the argument up specifically.
Yes, Your Honor, and what I would argue is that this has consistently been the United States' position throughout, that this was an error, both in our brief before the lower court as well as before this court. And I would actually point to not just my language, but the language of this court, United States versus Parker, in expressly dealing with the law of the case doctrine, which is an appellate policy versus a legal doctrine, a binding legal doctrine. In United States versus Parker, 62 MJ 459, and this is at 465 from this court in 2006. That quote from that case is, the government had little incentive to appeal the erroneous aspects of the lower court's decision. The government emerged from the proceedings below, and in this case, I'll paraphrase, with an affirmed findings and sentence. If we were to apply the law of the case doctrine here, we would be sending the government a message that an appeal should be lodged in every case where the lower court has articulated an incorrect legal standard, no matter how incidental the error from the government's perspective, and no matter how insignificant the result.
Let me ask you a question about this case, then. Spare you the rest of the dramatic reading. Why is it a way of the world that a member would understand and know as a matter of common sense and knowledge about the ways of the world, absent any evidence, what the recidivism rate is for a person who was convicted of a sexual offense against a child?
Thank you, Chief Judge Baker. What I would say is, at least initially, that's not what was actually put out there by trial counsel. It was not any sort of specific recidivism rate. What was put out there was asking the members to use their common sense and ways of the world to evaluate the evidence.
Whether he would molest again.
Well, what potential, and that he poses a potential
risk to
society.
We want to protect young girls from the same fate. Every day he spends in jail will be one day less that he doesn't have to worry about him being out on the street and no other girl can suffer the same fate.
And that RK and no other girl could suffer the same fate. And Chief Judge Baker, what I believe is certainly before this court, as objected to by defense counsel, was the comment in rebuttal. But even addressing both, it was actually appellants himself and trial defense counsel actually put the reference out there to appellant's potential risk to society. Appellant, in his unsworn statement, it wasn't the government that said it, stood up and said.
One of the concerns this court has is that even people who are convicted of sexual offenses against children deserve to have fair trials and fair sentencing procedures and to be convicted for what they do and not for what people fear they might do or society might fear they might do. And one concern with the government's position here is the government seems to be arguing that it's fair game to tell members that the person is a child molester and therefore protect the rest of the society.
Well, Your Honor,
does the government not believe people should be sentenced based on the crime they commit, not the crime people fear they will commit?
Your Honor, I would say that the government agrees with that assertion, that accused should be sentenced based upon the crimes they commit, and the military judge instructed the members adequately on that.
By telling them that they should use the ways of the world in assessing whether the implications suggested by counsel is correct?
That's part of it, Your Honor, but the military judge went on to remind them that the appellant was to be sentenced based upon the evidence and his convictions alone. And one of the principles of sentencing, the core principles of sentencing that military judge instructs on in every case, has instructed on for decades, is protection of society. So in looking at sentencing an individual for the crimes that they commit, the members are permitted to look at protection of society, and that was instructed to them by the military
judge. When the trial counsel says, I'm just arguing ways of the world, sir. And then the judge says, members, arguments of counsel aren't evidence, but you can use the ways of the world. Shouldn't he have given a bit more nuanced instruction? Doesn't that just bolster exactly what's going on?
Judge Suki, I would say no in this instance because...
Why?
Because trial counsel didn't make any specific assertions with regard to recidivism rates or that he was going to offend again. Simply asked the members to use their common sense and knowledge of the ways of the world
to infer that he's going to offend again. And then the judge says the arguments of counsel aren't evidence, but you can use the ways of the world.
And part of that ways of the world in evaluating that evidence is appellant's own assertion that he was going to have to register as a sex offender, and his trial defense counsel amplifying that in argument. And certainly it's within the common sense and knowledge of the ways of the world of any average member of why sex offender registration exists. Appellant certainly put it out there so he could ask for leniency in sentencing about the effects that sex offender registration is going to have.
You're losing me. You haven't addressed the judge's instruction.
I think the judge's instruction, Judge Suki, was absolutely appropriate, and this is why. Because trial counsel didn't make any connections explicitly or in the members' minds for how to connect this argument. Trial counsel stopped there. After defense counsel's objection, trial counsel didn't go any further with the ways of the world.
He didn't go any further because he was cut off by an objection.
That was overruled. And she did not continue in her argument to address that any further. Had the military judge made any more explicit findings and tried to instruct the members about what their common sense and knowledge of the ways of the world is, which our members are supposed to bring in as their individual common sense and knowledge of the ways of the world, had this military judge gone any further and tried to be any more nuanced, given no specific assertion by trial counsel, that simply would have compounded any minimal error that might have actually been there.
Counsel, rather than refighting the battle that you lost at the CCA, why don't you address the issue that we actually granted on, which was the prejudice issue?
Yes, Judge Ryan, thank you. And appellant was correct in describing how that issue is framed, how this court should analyze that issue. And even in United States versus Halpin, this court has said that you can look at the issue of prejudice without even addressing the question of error, even if it's before the court. I think that would be appropriate in this case, in any case. In this case, you have to look at the three prongs of Fletcher, which are also discussed in United States versus Halpin: the severity of the misconduct, any curative measures taken by the military judge, and then also the strength of the evidence supporting the sentence in this case. And the United States believes that all three of those prongs, all three of those factors, rest solely with the government, are heavily in favor of the government. First, looking at the severity of the misconduct, we're looking at 14 words, one sentence from a
rebuttal. What could be more inflammatory and severe than suggesting that someone is a lifelong child molester?
Chief Judge Baker,
14 words, those are going to be the worst 14 words you could possibly say to someone.
14 words certainly could be much worse, and this court has looked at words that are much worse than this in various cases that this court has looked at under this. For instance, United States versus Halpin, United States versus Marsh, United States versus Erickson, United States versus Schroeder.
Why don't you do the third prong of the test rather than the first two?
Absolutely, Chief Judge Baker. The third prong of the test, the evidence supporting the conviction in this case was overwhelming. Similarly to United States versus Halpin, this court can decide this case based solely upon that third prong, and we believe it certainly could be done in this case. What the members had before them in this case, appellant argues that in their brief that the government's case was weak, case in aggravation. But to have this court buy that argument would be to ignore RCM 1001F2, which says that the court-martial may consider any evidence properly introduced on the merits before findings. And what you have to look at in this case, and what the members had before them, is the testimony of RK, the child victim in this case. It's tearful, heart-wrenching testimony that took place, that's contained at Joint Appendix 51 to 79. It was uncrossed testimony, uncrossed by appellant. He had the opportunity to, but did not do so. That described the actual events that happened when this 30-year-old man who had moved into her house lay down beside her, groped her breast, put his hands on her vagina, and put his fingers inside of her vagina. This 10-year-old child, this was before the members as well, that she was unable to bring the words to tell her father and had to write him a note. Daddy, that guy moved in downstairs, was touching me in the wrong places. Prosecution Exhibit 5, that was before the members, and Joint Appendix 81. I would put before this court the trial counsel could have stood up, could have displayed Prosecution Exhibit 5, could have displayed Prosecution Exhibit 7, the photograph of that little girl, and sat back down, and the members would have judged the same exact sentence that they had judged in this case. And that wasn't all that the members had before then. They also
How do you know that they would have judged the same exact sentence? How do you know that they wouldn't have judged a sentence for 15 years or 10 years? I mean, how do you know that?
Well, what I can certainly say, Judge Erdman, is that the members, I think this court can be confident the members sentenced based on the evidence and wouldn't have gone under that 8 years if trial counsel had simply put that evidence up there and sat back down. And I think also it was before the members that's important to consider is that there was another victim in this case, not just R.K. Master Sergeant K., R.K.'s father, did the right thing, invited a subordinate, another airman, into his home. He needed a place to stay, and he brought him in. And it was that person that he brought into his home that he let in that raped his child. And he's got to live with that for the rest of his life as well, and the members knew that as well. When you compare that with the relatively weak mitigation case that appellant put on, five unremarkable character letters from a pastor, an ex-fiancé, and family members, as well as a contrived, unsworn statement where he purports to apologize, but yet also says he didn't intend for any of this to happen, despite being convicted of rape of a child and aggravated sexual contact of a child, this court can be confident that appellant was sentenced based upon the evidence presented and not anything that an assistant trial counsel stood up and said in her sentencing argument or the rebuttal sentencing argument. And that's particularly true when you look at the context of trial counsel's argument as well. The objected to portion that we're talking about here in this case was a relatively small portion with which courts have looked at in determining the prejudice. And this court can certainly, based upon that evidence, and consistent with this court's precedent in the United States versus Halpin, be confident that the appellant was sentenced based upon the evidence alone. Appellant took 8 years of his child's life. He offended on her, he raped her, he committed aggravated sexual contact on her when she was 10 years old. He took away 8 years of her childhood. The members took 8 years back from him as punishment for his crimes against her. It certainly defies logic and common sense and reason for us to believe that appellant's argument that this trial counsel's argument and these 14 words, no matter how egregious the court ultimately finds these words to be, that the members were so inflamed, their passions were so inflamed by this, that they were buying every word, that they believed, even if we're going to go so far as to say trial counsel was saying that appellant was going to offend again, that they go back there with this belief that he's going to offend again, and after careful deliberation, sentence him to 8 years.
Would this be a different case if the defense counsel had asked for 5 years?
Judge Ryan, it would be certainly a consideration before this court. I don't think the result would change. It would be certainly a different argument. But in this case, the defense actually got exactly what they asked for from the members. And I think that's an important consideration for this court. The trial counsel asked for 10 years, and the defense said conceded the confinement was appropriate, but said give him some amount less than 10 years. And appellant received a sentence 2 years less than that 10 years requested by trial counsel. I think that alone can convince this court that he had nothing to do with trial counsel's argument. And if the members were truly so inflamed and truly believed that appellant was going to go out there and rape other children, was going to be this serial child molester, they would have sentenced him to much longer than 8 years. 8 years for his crimes, for committing a rape and an aggravated sexual contact of a child at the age of 10 years old, was a careful result of careful deliberations based upon the evidence, and was certainly, the United States would say, lenient in this case based upon the offenses that appellant committed. And as we've discussed prejudice, I think we also discussed some of the argument as far as why this case wasn't error, and I'll briefly discuss that issue before concluding. Here, appellant invited the response from trial counsel when he put out that he was going to have to register as a sex offender. We think that's important for this court to consider because trial counsel didn't make specific assertions about recidivism rates. Appellant recognized that society recognizes the unique nature of his offenses. Society recognizes the unique danger that individuals who commit these offenses pose to that very society. And when appellant put it out there, he put it before the members, and it was certainly fair comment for trial counsel then ask the members to consider their common knowledge and the ways of the world. That common knowledge and the ways of the world is something that we expect under Article 25 for our members to bring in with them. They're the best qualified based upon age, experience, training. And I think United States versus Rivera, which was cited in our brief but also discussed by appellant, is informative in this case in what common sense knowledge and the ways of the world can be used for. It says in that case, members can rely on everyday common sense and the knowledge of human nature and the ways of the world, expect the triers of fact who have been to the program, trained in the combat arms, or read the sports page. Certainly the members in this case would understand what sex offender registration is there for. That appellant put it out there that he is going to pose a potential danger to society later, and it's certainly...
Okay, counsel, you're talking about recidivism and about the fact that he would pose a risk to society in the future. But let's look at the words that were used by the trial counsel. He said, quote, defense counsel said, quote, there's no evidence before you that he's done anything like this before, and then refers to the ways of the world. Isn't he arguing to the panel, we know that he has been a child molester in the past?
I wouldn't think so.
But wait a minute.
Yes, sir.
Why don't you think so when he says there's no evidence before you that he's done anything like this before, but then says, and there is no evidence before you, but think what we know, common sense ways of the world, about what child molesters do.
Mr. Jolson, I think that's a fair question, given the argument. In a vacuum, I would say maybe so, that interpretation of the argument could take place. But given that this is rebuttal and in response to a specific argument by defense counsel, and I believe trial counsel...
But the argument was about recidivism and about sex offender registration having to do with future conduct. This is an allegation about what he must have done in terms of past conduct.
And with respect, I would disagree, Judge Olson, that this is an argument about his past conduct. I think this is trial counsel saying that this is a potential risk to society and that should be taken into account when adjudging an appropriate sentence. And I would take that a step further and say, even as a matter of law, we recognize that individuals that commit crimes like this have a propensity to engage in these crimes. For instance, we're held to even be accused of this crime in the future. Not willing to commit, willing to be accused of it. The government could put out evidence of propensity as society recognizes the unique danger that someone who commits these type of offenses poses, and appellant is the one who put that information before the member. So I believe it was that trial counsel was referring to.
If you're talking about prospective misconduct, here, isn't he talking about past misconduct?
I don't think so, Judge Olson, especially because trial counsel actually made the specific reference that there is no evidence that he's done this before. Had trial counsel said something to the effect of, this would be an argument that would be going to pass misconduct. Had trial counsel said, well, there's no evidence before us that he's done this before.
But we know and he immediately says, and there is no evidence before you, but think what we know, common sense weighs the world.
And that was in the context, Judge Olson, that I would argue of the defense counsel's argument that he's not going to pose a danger to other children. I think that's what this was in response to, directly in response to, when trial counsel stood up in rebuttal. And that's why I would argue that it wasn't going to pass misconduct, because it's got to be framed by what they were responding to. And they were responding to that specific assertion by defense counsel that he poses no danger to other children. And Chief Judge Baker, pending any further questions, I'll briefly conclude.
I thought you just did that. This is the brief conclusion of the brief conclusion?
It is a brief conclusion, though.
Okay.
Appellant's claim before this court should fail, as he suffered certainly no prejudice from this alleged improper argument, given the fact that he received an 8-year sentence, which was lenient in this case, and exactly what appellant asked for at trial. Even if this court were to look at the error question, trial counsel's argument properly put into context the evidence that was put out there by appellant and his trial defense counsel and did not constitute an improper argument. For that reason, the appellant's findings and sentence should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the appellant, opportunity for a rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The government has the burden of showing that there was no harm in this case, and they have not been able to meet that burden. The only thing that they've articulated is the fact that the appellant got at least one day less than 8 years, because that's what they asked for, and the fact that trial counsel was simply rebutting defense counsel's argument. It's illustrative to go back and to look at the joint appendix. On page 20 of the joint appendix, in trial counsel's opening sentencing argument, went on about the fact that, page 22, that we need to protect young girls from the same fate that we're trying to protect and comfort for everything that he has put her through.
Well, now, isn't protection, though, one of the 5 stated reasons for sentencing consideration? Protection of society in general?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so that statement in and of itself wouldn't be objectionable, would it?
It was not objected to, Your Honor, by this defense counsel, who seemingly thought it was permissible, at least with how the argument was going. But the defense counsel then did the appropriate thing in their rebuttal argument, and they got up and they said, you know, on page 25 of the joint appendix and 27 of the joint appendix, that there is no evidence before you that the appellant or the accused at that point was the type of person that showed any sort of recidivism or the type of person that had those traits. Specifically, the government put on a person, a detective, who said that he was on the low end of the scale of somebody who would demonstrate recidivism. And then this then opened the door on page 31 for the trial counsel to get back up and make the comment, panel members, you know, there is no evidence before you that he's going to be a child molester, but wink, wink, nod, nod, we know all about child molesters, common sense and ways of the world. And that is the idea, without any facts and evidence, that the trial counsel wanted to send back with the panel members, that if they did not commit the appellant to a harsh sentence of confinement, that he was going to be running around out there in the world, reoffending, molesting.
Well, assuming that's true, but they didn't. They gave him 8 years. So where does that leave us?
Your Honor, that leaves us at that delta. That 8 years is the sentence that was adjudged with that inflammatory comment. The members adjudged that sentence to prevent the appellant from seemingly going out and molesting young girls.
We can't know that.
We don't know that, Your Honor.
No,
that is
we can't know that.
Well, in your view, how would the you're saying it's the government's burden, and under facts like these, how in your view can the government meet it? I mean, it seems to me you're saying that they never could.
That I can't answer, Your Honor. It is not the appellant's burden. All we can comment is that looking at the arguments that have been put forth, they have not met that burden.
But
to show that.
But under Fletcher, under the third test in Fletcher, it's the weight of the evidence. And so, as the government argues, can't they argue that the evidence in this case was so overwhelming that it doesn't matter what happened on the first two elements?
They can, Your Honor, and that was the argument that was put forth in Halpin and the decision that this court put out. But this case is strikingly different from the case in Halpin. First and foremost, the defense counsel in that case never objected to the improper argument. So this court reviewed that for plain error, where the appellant had the burden of proof to prove the harm. Here, this is strikingly different, where the defense counsel did object, and the burden rests with the government.
But as far as the evidence, the overall evidence goes, it's my understanding that there really wasn't any contention as to whether or not this behavior occurred. The defense argument was that if it did occur, he thought it was his girlfriend. And so there really is no dispute as to whether the incident occurred. You know, he was arguing that I didn't know I was going to do that. So, and that, along with the victim's testimony, seems to me to be pretty strong evidence.
And I mean, and you talk about a delta between what the government asked for, or what he was given and what he might have been given, but there's also the delta between what he was given and the maximum sentence that he faced, right? Which was what?
Life.
Without parole.
Without WAP, yeah.
And Your Honors, I would not, I'm not, the members found the appellant guilty in findings. And I'm not here today to justify the actions or to limit the effect. But I do think, with that said, that we need to put these facts in perspective.
But you would agree, that if you were sentenced to one day confinement, you wouldn't be here arguing that we could not be confident that it did not impact members, correct?
Your Honor, I think we would be here because it would still be an improper argument. But I think with that sentence, at the very low end of the spectrum, that would be more difficult.
But you're saying that 8 years is not, leaves you with doubt, and perhaps us with doubt, that members may have considered the improper argument in sentencing.
Correct, yes, Your Honor.
But in your world, there's as a matter of theory, there is some sentence that you would be confident in. Is that correct? Or you just can never be confident because you just have no idea what members would have done.
Your Honor, if it was one day, I'm sure.
Okay. But your point is somewhere between 8 and 1, and it's closer to one day.
Yes, Your Honor. Without removing the specter of that improper argument, we just cannot be sure that the panel members didn't sentence him because they believed he was going to be some raging child molester.
I get it. Any other questions up here? Do you want to say something at the end, summarize?
If I may, Your Honor, briefly. Child counsel insinuates to the members that child molesters are serial offenders and that appellant would reoffend unless the panel adjudged a lengthy sentence to confinement. Those improper inflammatory comments by trial counsel constituted prejudice under the Fletcher test. As a result, this court cannot be confident that the appellant was properly sentenced based on the weight of the evidence alone. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is now submitted, and the court thanks both counsel, and we stand on recess until further order of the court.
Court stands adjourned until further order of the court.